policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. This lodge, to carry on the work of disseminating theosophy, is found in the original writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge, has two weekly meetings, one monthly meeting, and occasional forums or symposiums. This month of January, the subject for the Sunday presentations is the path of spiritual evolution. Next Sunday, the 16th, the title is, in quotes, Nature Unaided Fails. On Wednesday evenings, we have a study class from 7:45 to 9 in the Ocean of Theosophy. We will be beginning Chapter 8 on Reincarnation this Wednesday night. But also on Wednesday night from 5:30 to 7:30, a reference library is open for your use. On one Friday a month, the third Friday of the month, we have a special meeting on comparative science, philosophy, religion. And this month, it is January 21st, and it's Buddha's Dhammapada. The work done here at this lodge, or any United Lodge wherever in the world you may attend, is all done on a voluntary basis. It is students serving theosophy. It is also totally supported by voluntary donations. And of course, money is critical to keep the lights on and the oil paid, and all donations may be made at the book table or there's a small box in the hallway. This morning's title has this for a reading. It's from the writings of Robert Crosby. If we dimly grasp the nature of masters, we will be able to reverence them in our hearts and to endeavor to draw near to them in our innermost being. Nor will we be deceived by claims made by or for this or that person, nor take it for granted that books written with the purpose of defining masters' powers, place, or imagined individual characteristics have any value whatever. All such are mere speculations, and an attempt, in fact, to drag those great beings down to our plane of terrestrial conceptions, a misuse of sacred names, as H.P.B. wrote in The Key to Theosophy. Masters are facts in nature. Facts, however, which our highest ideal will not fully encompass. Let us therefore endow them with the highest we can conceive of, try to assimilate that highest within ourselves, endeavor to draw near to them in our heart of hearts, and thus form for ourselves that line of communication which they have said they are always ready to help establish. And let us keep that ideal as a sacred thing in the repository of our hearts, not to be lightly thought of nor spoken of, but as a shrine of our highest aspirations, safely guarded from all intrusion, sacred and secret. Thus and thus only may we in time come to know them face to face. Our title for this morning, Mahatmas, Ideal and Fact of Human Perfectibility.
It's a wonderful time of year for a topic like this. We're at a time of renewal, of re-beginning, of considering our lives, our purpose, our goals, our virtues, our values, and that which we hold sacred for the coming year, which are the vows that we make, the resolutions. So it's a perfect time of year to consider that all of that mentioned, and as was described particularly at the end of the reading, is our attempt to take what may seem mundane and honor it as sacred, which is exactly what today's topic is about. Going from the mundane to the spiritual, a process, a sacrament, a sacrifice, which is why we're here, what we're doing, the path of our evolution. It is the reason we take on these bodies of form. To consider that it's a possibility, we have only to look at our culture. The young one says, I want to learn to ride a bike. And the parents say, you can do it, you can do it. It gives them enthusiastic confidence that this is possible. And soon the child learns to master the art of bike riding. And as we grow older, we decide, I want to choose this for my life's work. And someone will say, set your sights on the stars, reach for the stars, be the best that you can be. And so we set off in that direction. We come to the new year and say, I want to choose this as my direction for this year, and I am vowing to make my best effort in all of it, make it sacred. And so we believe that perfectibility is possible. Otherwise, there'd be no reason to get out of bed when you think about it. We have it in our very nature, a core belief or truth or idea that is true to ourselves, that perfectibility is possible. So there must be the flowering of that. If we are at the stage, maybe we consider it as a spiraling ladder of evolution. If we are somewhere in that process, knowing that there are steps on the rung below where we have already worked and steps above that we aspire to, we can then use our power, our spiritual power of imagination, to ideate those who have trodden all the steps in this period of evolution and have become the flower of it. And we call those Mahatmas, great beings, great souls, the perfected ones. Knowing, however, that life endures and cycles roll forever, there will be greater periods of expression and greater possibilities for perfectibility in the future. So we have handed down to us in myth, in legend, in oral tradition from generation to generation, stories of those great ones. And we come to a time in our more recent history where we can trace the lines of those who have come back to help mankind, which is what they are forever vowing to do. Those who have decided not to go into that state of bliss they have earned, but rather in honoring what they have learned to turn and help what they might call infant humanity or their younger brothers and sisters. So we see in many expressions, in many cultures, in many ways, the flowering and the names Krishna, Buddha, Christ, all different levels, Lao Tzu, Pythagoras, those who have mastered certain parts of life and are on their way to becoming that flower, that Buddha, that Christos principle. Apollonius of Tiana, Melchizedek, if you investigate any of these familiar or perhaps unfamiliar names, they will lead us to the lives of the personages, the work, which is where we are to concentrate. None of those teachers, master teachers, ever said, "Worship me, remember my name." Rather, they always pointed to, as we do with children, greater than this you can do. Not only what I have accomplished, but forever there is this possibility of perfectibility. So they offered what they knew, what they had learned, what had been verified by ages of seers, not the learnings of one, but rather the collective wisdom, and remind us that there is a master soul, there is a oneness, there is a unity, a divinity that resides within all of life. This is the fact. The ideal is that flowering of the use, the highest use of all the powers belonging to that spark of divine oneness. So there are plenty of levels and conditions and learnings as life is a great school, Mr. Crosby reminds us. And it is always going on. There are conditions which are necessary for those who are perfecting themselves. We must master a knowledge of exoteric and esoteric science. The visible and the invisible world must be where we do the work in the visible world, but we investigate all of life. We try to lift the veil and uncover that hidden knowledge as we are fit to do so. The end of the declaration said, we fit ourselves to be the better able to help and teach others. This is our motive. This is our devotion. So as we are able to take hold of that carnal nature and control the swayings of, we'll go into more of that detail in a moment, swayings of the terrestrial man, we honor the spiritual in bringing that into alignment so as to work in the very best way for all of life. And this is a complete unselfishness. We talk about selfishness, unselfishness, and selflessness. And the Mahatma, the very greatest learner or blossomed soul, would be that selfless soul where there wouldn't be the faintest inkling of the personal or what is good for the one, but rather ever centered in the all, in the oneness. So in studying man's nature. We know we are sevenfold. We know we have the four lower principles which support the man of skin, the three higher principles supporting all of life and active as we set them afire. But initially we have spirit, spiritual, soul, and mind, Atma, Buddhi, Manas. And we have been discussing in the Ocean of Theosophy, we are partially, that mind is partially lit up. Who does the rest of that work? We do. That is our purpose. And those who have done that work for ages and ages of time have come to the point where they are able to completely control everything of the lower man and so transmute it, raise it up to the higher. Just there are pages of names, but they are all over the world, the universe. We look at names like Pythagoras, Plato, Arjuna in Mexico, Quetzalcoatl, great name, Nagarjuna, Sankaracharya, Sankapa. We hear these names in these rooms, and for the moment, we're intrigued by them, and then we let them go. The invitation in Theosophy is to spend some time getting to know them, as was brought out in the reading, reaching up to those beings, those adepts and perfected souls. They patiently await the time when we become awake and aware. They are not able to interfere with our karma. That would go against natural law. We can see that. They are not able to reach down to us unless perhaps it were in an after-death state in Devakan to remind us that we made a vow to keep working and come out of that state of bliss. But generally, it is we who need to reach up to them, to recognize who and what they are, seek to follow that path as the best expression of that spirit within. So that would be a description of the ideal. And we wonder then how we will ever get there in our workaday world with all of our trials and tribulations. And Mr. Wadia, quoting the Gita, reminds us, through inquiry and search, humility and service, the disciple is taught by the seers and knowers of the essence of things. Inquiry and search, to seek for ourselves this wisdom, always with help. We're never without help, of course, but to light that fire ourselves. Humility and service. And we hear phrases like, to seek to be as nothing in the eyes of another, to do the right thing because it is there to be done. This is how we honor that humility and service. So, of course, we need knowledge. We seek and search that. We need a willingness to conquer the desires of the personal man. And we think this is so difficult for us at this period in our evolution. That principle of desire is eminently obvious at this period. And if we allow ourselves to be swayed by the desires of the personal man, for the me, the good, what's good for me, we are straying from that path. The moment we recognize there was a better choice, and now I will make that, putting will actively into motion, we have readjusted and regained balance, and then walking that path again. Dauntless energy and patience sweet, and we think the energy comes from doing the work. There are days where I'm sure we feel we just can't even get done what's in front of us. But if we try and even do a little, we are honoring that duty that we have brought to ourselves. And patience sweet, it is said, that naught can ruffle. From the voice, have patience, candidate, as one who fears no failure, courts no success. Fix thy soul's gaze upon the star whose ray thou art, the flaming star that shines within the lightless depths of ever-being, the boundless fields of the unknown. Could we really be that? We are that. We are promised that. It has been handed down from time immemorial, that thou art. If that is true, then what am I truly capable of? What are we all truly capable of? Mr. Judge says to us, all things come to him who waits in the right way. Make yourself in every way as good an instrument for any sort of work as you can. When the hour strikes, it will then find you ready. So where do we begin looking? And from, we're sorry for all the quotes, but they're so wonderful, we wanted to share them. From Light on the Path, it tells us, start by looking at nature. Inquire of the earth, the air, and the water, of the secrets they hold for you. The development of your inner senses will enable you to do this. Then inquire of the holy ones of the earth, of the secrets they hold for you. The conquering of the desires of the outer senses will give you the right to do this. Finally, of course, look within, thou art Buddha. Inquire of the inmost, the one, of its final secret, which it holds for you through the ages. And that is what we aspire to. Mr. Crosby tells us it's by dwelling on that perfectibility, that inherent perfectibility, that we get rid of our imperfections. We don't spend time worrying about that which for the moment we can't control. We look at it dispassionately. How am I better able to do this? Spend time considering that it is possible. We are inherently perfectible. And then act as we best can in that moment, taking stock of it and knowing we'll do better next time with considered effort. So take the plant, the blossom. The leaves will consider small passing acts, and we consider those our everyday duties, our little kindnesses. The flowers would be the beautiful acts. Perhaps those things we have watched and adjusted and done better. And then the fruit is our creative acts. And these we think would be the best use of will and desire. And we're told these are offerings to the highest in man, confirming the spiritual within. And we're told we honor that deity within when we consciously make every act on the mundane plane a spiritual sacrifice. Every act, breathing, thinking, seeing, I am using powers of the soul to do this. This is not an automatic process. This is a gift, a spiritual gift, an earned right to use this power. How we then use it and infuse it with whatever coloring we give it, we either honor it or dishonor it. And we know if we make poor use of something over time, eventually we're going to lose it or have to work very hard to get it again. So we need to pay attention. So what's so hard about this? This sounds like either something we should be able to do or something very, very far away from us. Well, we think it's our passions and desires. We so want whatever it is that we can't see anything but that. And if that desire is not in the right direction, in the direction of soul wisdom, then we are, again, really off the mark. And it tells us the basis of every act is desire. Both the act and its consequences are the effect, the cause being on the plane of desire. So we have to ever check what our motive is, what our motivation, what our direction is, and why we wanted to do something. We're told to restrain by the divine, the lower self. Restrain by the eternal, the divine. Great is he who is the slayer of desire. Still greater he in whom the self divine has slain the very knowledge of desire. So we are ever reaching up, ever trying to gain control. And the Gita tells us when the man, so living in that direction, centers his heart in the true self, the spirit within, and is exempt from attachment to all desires, he is as a lamp which is sheltered from the wind, flickering not. So there is a steadiness of that fire, of that devotion. So what might be our highest aspiration on this path? We think the word love sums it up, and we can trivialize that word, but in its truest sense, the power to love born of dispassion. Shakespeare speaks of the conditions which none can fulfill except those practicing the discipline of a disciple. Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds, or bends with the remover to remove. Oh no, it is an ever fixed mark that looks on tempests and is never shaken, the lamp that flickers not. So it is that permanent within. It is recognizing we are in control of the temporary without. It is recognizing the permanent is within. The temporary are these conditions and circumstances that we have created and therefore can overcome. So using discrimination and following ethics, we find a balance of the intellect and the emotions and then are better able to make choices for the future. And our true desire, remaining fixed in the highest ideal, is how we transmute to a higher plane our thoughts, words, and acts. Your thoughts and questions are invited. Yes.
Well, these thoughts of a higher ideal, these masters that you talked about, the fact of being, do we have any connection with them? And how are we connected?
How are we connected with these masters if we are? Well, we can't imagine an instant where we are not connected to them. If this divine principle, this deific essence or spiritual unity, is the center and sustainer of all of the expressions of it, ourselves, the masters, the stone, the animal, the plant, all in different degrees of evolution, if it is within and infused and sustaining all of life, there is no disconnection between the lowest and the highest. And man standing at the point where he becomes self-conscious, that small s self can recognize that capital S self and then the full capital letter self, which we heard described in a recent meeting, is the whole purpose for why we are here. So there is complete connection, no difference between ourselves and the highest master, but that we haven't finished our work and perhaps haven't realized that fact, to follow up.
Well, in the Gita, there's a dialogue that goes on between Arjuna and Krishna. Now, we know that, well, we suppose that we are Arjuna. Krishna? Are we Krishna as well? Is Krishna anywhere within our being or that?
We are Krishna in potential. Every one of us is Krishna in potential. We have mastered something in our nature. We have a talent or a tendency or a characteristic, something in our character we have mastered that no longer pops up as a karmic reminder. It In one person, it might cause terrific turmoil. In another, oh, it's okay. That has already been worked out. We have, in essence, quote, mastered it. It is in gaining complete control that we have the master, the adept, the ideal. Yes.
In regards to that, we really are Krishna. Only Krishna knows it,
mm-hmm.
and we as Arjuna don't know it. So we were thinking a mundane way of putting it. They are called our elder brothers. A brother has a relation to you that few do. I mean, you're more closely related to your siblings than to anybody else, than your parents, than anybody. So there's a very immediate relationship. Well, your elder brother isn't home. He's off doing something incredible and major and important to the world. So you don't have direct contact with him. But what you have is mail. It's called the Bhagavad Gita and Light on the Path and the Voice of the Silence and all the spiritual texts that we have are letters from our elder brothers
mm-hmm.
to us. So we ignore the contact. It's always there,
mm-hmm.
but we choose to go get busy in the sensual part of life.
So we are Krishna. We don't recognize it. We appreciate that distinction. And yeah, these are love letters in a sense because they are the highest dispassion. They are strictly for our benefit from those who have trodden the path before us. And as was said, we look at them. Sometimes we read them. Sometimes do we study them? Do we let them resonate within and feel that vibrational connection? Or are they just books on the shelf? That's up to us. Yes.
Is the master completely evolved beyond this physical plane?
Is the master completely evolved beyond this physical plane? The highest master? Because there are certainly many, many degrees. Right. Right. Let's take the highest Mahatma, great soul, Mahatma. Are they evolved beyond this physical plane? Yes and no. They do not need the body for existence, but could use a body if need be for contact. They don't need it, but they could. Rarely would they, because the bodies of our time period would be to them pollution, in a sense. They are lowest terrestrial, made of the lower kingdoms. Remember, we are, the physical form is sitting on the design body. It is molded around and through and into that astral form, which is the inner senses, the inner form, that which extends to a certain level past the physical. So certainly on those inner planes, they could use a form of a different nature, of a different plane. But rarely would we think of, as the very few examples through an enormity of time, would they come back and use a physical body. Any ideas on that? No? Okay. Yes?
No, it wasn't to address this, but I was going to say, what is the greatest difficulty that holds us back from attaining this?
We think one of our great difficulties in this process, certainly at this time, is fear. We can all remember back in our childhood, if we were fortunate enough to live in a place where we knew our neighbors were as responsible for us as children as our parents were. We had to do what they told us, just as what our parents told us. And we think it is now a different kind of society where, for advancement, for whatever reason, you know, technology has kept us indoors more, we think. So we have less of a connection to those around us without effort, perhaps, than we did in the past. So rooted in the illusion of life is what fear is. It's concentrating on that which is temporary. Anything that might happen to us, that could happen to us, is a condition, is a karmic duty, is something that needs attention, needs to be conquered and moved on. It won't kill us because we are not able to be killed. If it takes our physical life, we know from these writings, these teachings, the cycle will turn and we will come again into a new body to continue the work. Yes, in the back.
We think the greatest difficulty is we don't know that it's even possible. How can you ever achieve something if you don't have it in your mind that it is achievable? So it's been kept from us through religion and materialistic science. The dogmas that are out there on both sides prevent us from even considering it. And it really is the duty of us as students to keep talking it up and presenting it. We were thinking the analogy we used, no, the masters aren't far away doing something, and that's why they're not at home. They are home. They're writing to us, their younger brothers, to remind us to make the trip home.
That's a good way to put it, yeah. So, the full power of soul resides, this was to an earlier question, resides in the bonds of spiritual interdependence, which reach out to and include all living things. All beings are sources of our individual strength. We love that line. All beings are sources of our individual strength, though they are such sources only because they are united in the divine unity, the one self, the universal will. So the attention placed anywhere else, engrossed in failure or doubt or ignorance, is a hindrance. Not recognizing what was described is a hindrance. We're working against ourselves for as long as we entertain that lack of knowledge, that ignorance, that fear, that doubt. And what we need to do is begin to be brave and step out and check these ideas. Am I one with all of life? Is there something that I can see within myself, and we'll probably hear more about it next week too, that I can point to in nature? What are the connections of myself and the rest of the world? When I look into the eyes of another soul, what is that vibration? Why would that be there, other than the fact that we are looking into the eyes of God, looking back into our own? Yes?
It's interesting that one of the things that, most important things that holds us back is our attachments.
Mm-hmm.
Our attachments to this world of illusion of that's so real to us.
Yes, absolutely.
We think of it as real because we can touch it, we can, but it's illusion, and we are attached to things.
Absolutely.
And
we
ideas.
We are attached to not only things and ideas, but what lies beneath and behind them, which is truly desire,
mm-hmm.
and what we choose to ideate or think about or consider. The attachment being full belief in, you know, we use that word attachment a lot and we think of a physical attachment, but there's a mind connection to what is false that is holding us back. Believing that we are not capable, as was stated differently, is our biggest hindrance. Believing, being attached to anything which is not entertained with the idea of spirit, is less than. And any time we do that and we spend time there, we've created another hindrance for ourselves. So it is we who take charge, check our desires and motives, check our results of acting, and choose to act and think and believe better in the future as we see fit. It is up to us. And if we were right, results will prove it. If we were wrong, results will prove it. It was wrong, find a better way. The scientists will tell you that every time. Didn't work, I tried something else. Yes.
We like the phrase that was used during the talk about using and infusing. And we need to use and infuse theosophy, which is divine wisdom, knowledge, and power. But we need to learn the philosophy first. Of course, at any stage, it said that we can correct some minor misconceptions that others may have, and maybe point them, if we don't have the words, we can point them to an article to read that might be very instructive. You know, the two most important ideas are karma and reincarnation, and even though in the last century or more, these ideas have gotten a lot of circulation, we'll say, but they're often very trite and distorted and childish, really, in a way. And it's sometimes difficult to really describe, even though you can have a knowledge of this, it really needs to be a living power. We need to infuse it so that we can overcome what is often the overwhelming force that is still there of dogmatic science and dogmatic religion. So
what we can be hopeful about, we think theosophy would agree with everything stated, what we can be hopeful about is all of these truths are eternally inherent in the very essence of ourselves. So there, although we have trouble expressing them, even a little bit of this can enliven something in the other that will help them begin to sift through. And we think one of the difficulties is our attachment, our unwillingness to give up our misconceptions. We have lived with an idea for so long, and it has suited us perfectly for the needs up till now. When we find out that was not the best use of whatever power we were using, and we begin to try and change it, everything within us might resist it, because we have built up so much power in the old method. So as it begins in mind, it really is a matter of, will I allow my false ideas to fall away? Maybe just mentally file them in a drawer. Maybe I'll look at them later, but allow room for the truth to take root. And then as we fight that fight against those patterns we have built up, we strengthen ourselves, we add something to the cycle when it returns, as we know. And Theosophy says no effort is wasted. So even if we can only plant a seed in the world, it is one more seed that may take root. Those leaves, the small passing acts, and the flowers and the fruit, they will grow if planted.
And we think that's why it's so important to use the Socratic method rather than just come at somebody and say, no, you've got it all wrong. You know, this isn't it. You know, they're not going to stick to heaven. They're going to go to Kamaloka first for maybe, you know, et cetera, et cetera,
right,
and give them some kind of theosophical rap. And you're there for them, but at the same time, you just have to gently
is
get
the
them to maybe question some things. Or, like you say, planting a seed, it's a small opening.
Absolutely. Using the best discrimination power we can muster, gently speak soul to soul. That soul is thirsty. If that situation has come to you, that is an opportunity, and that soul may not know that it's thirsty for this wisdom. So gently speak soul to soul and watch the results. If we immediately get resistance, back off a little bit, as was said, and figure another way or maybe another time when it's better to bring it up. But do it gently, offer it for consideration. You don't have to believe anything here. We're always told, take these ideas, check them for yourself, test them, make them real for yourself, and then begin to act differently. No, okay, in the back.
Well, everyone we meet is also a soul, and one with us in essence. Therefore, in reality, we do more help to other humans through our inner feelings, our inner struggles. It's like that expression, you know, let your light shine. You don't know how it's shining, but those who need it will see it. Even if they never hear of theosophy, they never meet you, they never come here, they get a glimmer of hope because you're full of it and you are shining it out.
Absolutely.
So our real work is within our own nature. And as you said, if karmically someone's brought to us, fine. But we don't have to go out and sing it to the world. We can do it just as perfectly inside ourselves.
And if we think back how we arrived to be meeting in these rooms, something or someone stood out for us. Either a friend came upon this and said, hey, I really think you're going to find this interesting. Or for some reason, one day, we've passed 100 times, we hear this all the time, I decided to come in. It might have been a title on the board, or it might have been someone they spoke with that was coming in the building. Something became apparent, and the soul recognized it and went with it. We can be those beacons, as was said, by our everyday behavior, by how we treat one another, by how we move through our day. And holding hope in mind is vitally important at this time. We know how many are suffering. Tragedies around the world between natural events and man-made events. The best way to overcome hatred is through love, through hope, through compassion. So the more we hold that in mind and begin to live that way, the more that effect and influence will be felt in the world. Yes?
Well, basically it sounds like you're saying that more so than as our personalities, it's the ideas that are circulating. We know for a fact that ideas have a life of their own, and they are similar to the little spores that we see in the spring floating about, carrying seeds. We don't know where they come from, but we do know that when they land, they bloom and blossom.
Absolutely.
And this is the way it is with these ideas. They are circulating. They are in the world now. They are moving, not as rapidly perhaps as we would like them to, but definitely as purposeful.
Wise ones have said, ideas rule the world. Yes.
Today is the day in 1776 that Common Sense was published here in Philadelphia. And if it hadn't been for those ideas, we wouldn't be sitting in America today having the freedom to discuss these ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something we need to think about more. We think you said it beautifully. Put those dumb ideas you've been holding on to all your life that don't work, and you know it, which is why you're questioning, and look for answers that make sense.
Common Sense was Thomas Paine?
That's right.
Okay. Real quickly, self-published, very quickly, we remember hearing a talk on Thomas Paine at one of the symposiums. As a child in England, Thomas Paine's school route took him past the stocks, thank you, where they would put prisoners, you know, hanging outside by their arms and their necks through the stock. And so often was it seen and felt by him that something was moved even as a child within him that knew this is not the right way to behave with one another. And that led to that idea of injustice in the world led to his later fantastic helping and influence on the United States being formed and the documents, and as was said, Common Sense is fantastic piece of literature and philosophy, as it were. So he was a great help and someone you might want to investigate. Yes?
There's something I read this morning. It says that we're attached to our divinity by our conscience.
We're attached to our divinity by our conscience.
And the other end is attached to our senses.
And the other end is attached to our senses. We think that is right on.
So obviously, his conscience called him a little stronger than his senses.
Absolutely. And it's a point we should consider. Our conscience, that which we know as right or wrong, is what? Speaking. What part of our nature? Yes?
Well, it can be learned from your parents, your teachers,
mm-hmm.
but in reality, theosophy says it is con science with knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
It is something you acquired painfully
mm-hmm.
in an earlier life,
right.
and you know it through and through. So when we go against our conscience, we're going against something we learned with pain.
And the seat of that learning, that carrying forward, is the Bodhi principle in our nature. Our spiritual soul retains all of the wisdom and the learning and the experience lifetime to lifetime that we have assimilated. So it is truly intuition. It is the voice of the silence speaking to us. And we think from the voice of the silence. There is a little quote here. There is but one road to the path. At its very end alone, the voice of the silence can be heard. The ladder by which the candidate ascends is formed of rungs of suffering and pain. These can be silenced only by the voice of virtue. So it is making the right choice to do the right thing, honoring, staying in line with, and bringing up to spirit those ideas that we hold to be true. We're working in line with our spiritual intuition. That pipeline, that conscience, what was it? Conscience to?
With science.
No, what was said earlier about conscience?
Oh, we're attached to our divinity.
Right, divinity. It's literally the attachment to the divine within us, working in harmony with what we know to be best, to be right, to be true, is honoring that divine, is working as the spiritual, is making sacred everything we're doing on this plane of action. Yes?
There's an old sort of parable that we, as a spiritual being, were sent as an ambassador to the lower kingdoms on this planet. We were to lift them up to the higher kingdom. Instead, we sort of fell in love with them and rolled around in it all, and we've lost our way, which is why we need the light from the masters, because we couldn't find it on our own, literally.
Right.
We wouldn't even dream it was possible.
Right. And as any child who is lost, hopefully the parent or the brother or sister will be looking, will be waiting, will be ready and there to assist, having more experience, more knowledge, understanding more than the one who is lost does at the moment. But as was said, that one is the potential of the elder brother or sister just waiting to be discovered, waiting to be remembered. We need to understand that we are all of the same essence in spirit, with the same potentialities of power, and over lifetimes working out these causes and their effects to better realize our true potential. And we are told if we change our ideas, then our actions will follow. It's what we are centered in. And again, putting that idea away in a folder, in a cabinet somewhere, even just for a time, and trying one of these principles out, we think will make a tremendous difference in our lives and those around us. And we'll be surprised. Sometimes we do it with disdain. I don't believe it. Let me try it. And we're shocked by the results. But it is always we who are acting and thinking and feeling and having effect on all of life around us. Although we don't believe we are that powerful, we are. Yes?
Same article, another idea. It says, he who wants to earn must labor. He who wants to learn must study. He who wants to serve must sacrifice. And this is the idea behind anyone or any being who intends to raise.
Could you repeat it again, please?
He who wants to earn must labor. He who wants to learn must study. He who wants to serve must sacrifice.
That's it. That's all of it right there. He who wants to earn must labor. We have to work for that which we wish to keep and make sacred. He who wants to learn must study. Knowledge is the beginning of this road, and knowledge with spirit becomes wisdom. And he who wants to
serve
must sacrifice. And sacrifice is the spiritual side of serving, when we offer it for the benefit of all.
What sacrifice means, to make sacred. Mm. But we were thinking, we have no way to reciprocate to these elder brothers.
Yes, we
except
do.
Except to do as they did, which
exactly.
is to serve.
Exactly.
So the service is to make sacred. But it isn't this big sacrifice. It is this giving back to what gave to you. And there's joy in that,
mm-hmm.
not pain.
Absolutely. It's the pay it forward idea. If we are truly feeling and working in this direction, when another says, you've given me such joy, wealth, whatever it might be, how can I repay you? The highest, we think, honor in that would be help another when the time comes. And there absolutely is joy in that. We're told when we feel our lowest or our sickest or our most bound down in this plane, it's a really good idea to do something for another, even something small. What it does is takes us out of this concentration on ourselves. It reminds us that we are strong, and it's honoring spirit to be helping in some way. So when we feel our lowest, look for a little opportunity somewhere to help someone. Hold a door, help someone out of a car. Smile, say thank you. The tiniest things become those little seeds of future blossoms. And it feels wonderful, because we are working in the right direction. It's the suffering comes because we're pushing that swinging door back so hard, it's going to slam us in the face at some point. It has to. So the more we go with the current, and we heard the idea about driving on the ice recently, when we begin to skid, we're told, turn into it, not away from it, because that's how you regain the control. Go with it, and then when your footing is solid, begin to regain your control. So we have all of these wonderful reminders and examples out there, and we're sitting here not recognizing we are spiritual dynamos. Well, an idea to take with us today from one of the Mahatmas. Look to the future. See to it that the continual performance of duty under the guidance of a well-developed intuition shall keep the balance. strive towards the light, all you brave warriors for the truth. But do not let selfishness penetrate into your ranks, for it is unselfishness alone that throws open all the doors and windows of the inner tabernacle. Brave warriors for the truth. Our class is over. Thank you.